When you fall in love, it is a temporary madness. It erupts like an earthquake, and then it subsides. And when it subsides, you have to work out whether your roots have become so entwined together that it is inconceivable that you should ever part.
To the complete works, an in-depth look into the career and the filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Micah Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true Cage-adom is my friend, a co-host, and a fellow Cage-aholic.
Mike DiCrescio. I'm not even going to do it.
Not going to do the accent.
Nope. I was kind of interested to see how you would say my name with that accent, but then I remembered that I'm the one who says my name.
Micah DiCrescio.
There you go. That sounded pretty good.
Dominic DiCocco.
So, Mike, I know that every episode of everything we do, I say I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah.
But today, I'm more interested to hear this movie better have a damn good, like, behind-the-scenes backstory that you've dug up. Because, like, I'm just not.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Usually I'm able to dig up a lot of production backstory. I was able to. Don't get me wrong.
I thought you were going to say there's just nothing.
Well, what I was going to say is usually I'm able to dig it up fairly easily. Like, if you go to the Wikipedia page on a movie, they'll usually say, like, here's the production segment about all the things that happened during production. If you go to the IMDb trivia page, they'll say all the interesting things that happened in the production. If you go to the Wikipedia page of this movie, it's a plot synopsis, the cast list, and the release. There's nothing about the production. If you go to the IMDb page, there are four trivia items, and trivia is a very loose term to describe a lot of these items. One of them is, like, this film guest includes three Oscar winners, and Katie Holmes auditioned for the role of Pelagia. So it's like, yeah, there's, like, trivia items, but it's not, like, relevant to the movie that I'm discussing. But I was able to find a website called cinnamon.com, which actually had a very lengthy description about the process of the making of this movie. So I do have some stuff to share with you, Mike.
Okay,
about Captain Corelli's mandolin, which is the name of the movie. We should say what the name of the movie is before we actually say
it. I thought you had said it. I was going to bring it up, but I thought you said it in the accent, and I can't remember anymore.
I did not. Captain Corelli's mandolin is the name of the movie we're going to be reviewing today. Now, Mike, in 1998, director John Madden, obviously well known for his football commentating career and video game franchise.
I'm not sure you have that right, Mike.
Yeah, you know, it might be a different John Madden. He directed a film that would go. wouldn't it be a better universe if this was the same John Madden?
It would absolutely be a better universe.
If the John Madden who created the video game franchise and comments on football games was also the director of Shakespeare in Love.
That's such better movie in my head now.
Anyway, in 1998, director John Madden directed the film that would go on to win Best Picture at the Oscars that year, Shakespeare in Love. And Shakespeare in Love also won a total of 7 Oscars that year, Mike. It was an insanely huge winner. Although John Madden lost Best Director, I should point out, to Steven Spielberg for Saving Private Ryan. And as this loss, I'm sure that has haunted him ever since. But after Shakespeare in Love won so many Oscars, whatever John Madden did next was going to be such a hot commodity, something that surely Academy voters would want to pay attention to when it got made. Now, around that time, another project was gearing up for director Roger Michel, which was an adaptation of the 1994 novel Captain Corelli's Mandolin by Louis de Bernier. Now, Michel today is known for directing films like Hyde Park on Hudson with Bill Murray as FDR and Morning Glory with Harrison Ford. At the time, he had just directed a pretty big hit, Notting Hill, with Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant. And at the end of that movie, Mike, Julia Roberts' character is actually shown reading the novel Captain Corelli's Mandolin, an in-joke hinting at Michel's next film.
Ooh.
Yeah. Alas, that was never meant to be. Roger Michel did not end up directing Captain Corelli's Mandolin because in the year 2000, he had a heart attack and had to drop out of the film to tend to his health.
Makes sense.
And it was at this point that director John Madden jumped in after reportedly loving the script. He got it one night, read it in one night, and like got himself attached to it like that, like right after reading it. He loved it so much. And although many of the roles were cast and the film was already well into pre-production, Madden worked with screenwriter Sean Slovo to shake up the script in a different direction, adding a wide variety of stories, subplots, and characters. So now, you've got a director on board whose last film cleaned up at the Oscars. You've got a cinematographer who shot films like Braveheart and The Thin Red Line. John Toll, by the way, great cinematographer. And you've got an Academy Award-winning actor in Nicolas Cage as the male lead, alongside other big names like Penelope Cruz, Christian Bale, and John Hurt, all of whom would go on to either win Oscars or be nominated for Oscars. And this movie had so much going for it, Mike.
Yeah.
You know, on paper, that's a phenomenal cast. You know, a director who's like hot off the heels of coming out with the best picture winner at the Oscars. So much going for this movie. And man, it does not deliver.
And the movie we get is just Captain Corelli's Mandolin.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
Critical consensus for this movie was pretty rough, Mike. I gotta tell you. It stands at a 29% of Rotten Tomatoes right now. Penelope Cruz even got herself a Razzie nomination for Worst Actress, which she lost. So I guess only the second worst actress of the...
All right, that's good, I guess.
She lost to Mariah Carey for the movie Glitter. I don't know.
Yeah. Yep.
It's fair. And the film was not a box office hit either, barely making back its budget, which was $57 million. Its final gross was about $62 million. So it made it back, but like just barely, and not enough to cover all the various costs that go into making a movie like this. This movie starred Nicolas Cage as Captain Antonio Corelli, the captain of a segment of the Italian army during World War II. Penelope Cruz stars as Pelagia, the Greek woman he falls in love with. John Hurt plays her father, Dr. Yanis. And I was excited to see him because I believe this is the first time I've watched him in something since he died a few weeks ago. So that was interesting.
I think that's right for me, too.
Actually, you know what? That's not correct. It's the first time I've seen him in something I hadn't seen before since he died. But I did rewatch History of the World Part 1 recently, where he has a cameo as Jesus in that movie. So I did see him. And Christian Bale stars in this movie, too, as Mandras, Pelagia's fiancé who goes off to war. Plus, David Morrissey is in this movie as Captain Gunther Weber. You may remember him as the governor from The Walking Dead. So that was kind of neat to see him. That was pretty cool. And Irene Pappas, who's a Greek actress who appeared in many films in the 50s and 60s, including Guns of the Navarone, plays Drosola. And finally, Patrick Malahide appears for one scene towards the end as a German colonel. He's the guy who plays Theon's father, Balon Greyjoy, on Game of Thrones.
Wow, yeah.
So that was pretty neat, too.
I think the continuing story of all of the character actors that are now big is a lot of fun with this podcast.
Yeah, I think it's a neat thing to look back at all these movies and see people who are recognizable in other things. And in the case of this movie, though, I will say a lot of the cast is filled with a bunch of Greek actors who I cannot possibly place on IMDb or Wikipedia or anything like that. There's so many of them and so many names that I cannot pronounce, and so I'm not even going to try. but if by chance one of them shows up in one of these Nicolas Cage movies, I will of course mention it, but I think it's doubtful that will happen. Anyway, Nicolas Cage has talked about this role a little bit, Mike, and what he was trying to convey with the role of Captain Antonio Corelli. And
in lightness.
Yeah, well, he was quoted with saying, with Corelli, I was able to show, I think, how Italians at their roots can be. Their love of music and creativity, for example, and their dislike of violence. Historically, Italians were not very aggressive as soldiers. They did not support fascism. And that's part of this movie. I mean, obviously, the Italian army was part of the fascist the Axis powers in World War II. But we don't think of the Italians as the bad guys in World War II. We always think of Germany and Japan.
Right.
I had actually forgotten about Italy. Like when I was watching the movie.
Just as a whole concept.
oh, when the movie started and it was like the Italian army is like invading this Greek town, I was like, oh yeah, Italy was the bad guys in,
yeah,
in World War
II. Long time. Yeah.
Yeah. And Nicolas Cage has also discussed some of the difficulties of working on this movie, especially working in 130-degree heat in wool uniforms, which I imagine is probably difficult. But he said the most difficult part for him was learning to play the damn mandolin. because he, according to Cage, he has no musical ability whatsoever. And so he was just constantly practicing this mandolin, and it essentially allowed him to mimic and memorize like 3 or 4 songs that you hear throughout the course of this movie. And that's like the extent of what he was able to learn of the mandolin. So it's, I guess he didn't take to it quite as well as he did race car driving and gone 6 seconds or, or binge drinking like leaving Las Vegas.
Wow, that was perfect. That's interesting to hear, considering at least between this and Family Man, music plays a pretty big role, or his performance of music.
Yeah, you know, we've seen I don't think it's about him singing. We've seen him sing a lot in these movies.
Like, yeah.
More than I had expected going into this podcast when we first started out, you know?
Yep.
But there is, he's singing in Wild at Heart. He's singing in, was it Moon? Does he sing in Moonstruck? I feel like he sings a little bit in Moonstruck.
Fucking probably. Who knows?
But he does some singing in The Family Man. He sings Peggy Sue Got Married. He does some singing in there.
Yep. Valley Girl, he's in the band.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of singing Cage, but we never see any, like, Cage playing an instrument, I don't think. It's always just singing.
Right.
So I think that's the difference here. And apparently he's not very good at them. I mean, I think he acquitted himself fine in the mandolin scenes. None of the songs really like stood out to me as like, wow, this is a great mandolin song. But I also don't know that I could point out a great mandolin song.
Right. I agree.
In any case, Captain Corelli's mandolin was written by Sean Slovo, best known for writing the 1988 film A World Apart based on her own experiences in South Africa, and who, for a time, served as Robert De Niro's personal assistant. Kind of neat. And the film was directed by John Madden 3 years after Shakespeare in Love and 4 years before 2K15.
What?
That was a video game joke. Madden, like Madden 2K15.
Oh, my God. Oh, I hate you so much right now.
No, 4 years before his next film, which was Proof, which starred Gwyneth Paltrow and Anthony Hopkins. In more recent years, he's become known for directing the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel movies, and most recently, 2016's Miss Sloan with Jessica Chastain, which I heard not great things about, but I heard that Jessica Chastain is great in it, and it basically redeems the entire movie. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Captain Corelli's Mandolin reads, when a fisherman leaves to fight with the Greek army during World War II, his fiance falls in love with the local Italian commander. A tale as old as time. So, Mike, what were your overall thoughts on Captain Corelli's Mandolin?
My overall immediate reaction is this movie is 2 hours and 13 minutes, which is 2 hours and 13 minutes too long. For most of the runtime, nothing's happening.
Oh, man.
And then for the other part of the runtime, like a tiny bit more is happening, and like that's it.
Yeah,
there's nothing going on in this movie.
Dude, this movie is so boring. And I usually don't like to I have legitimate criticisms, and I usually don't like to say this movie is boring and that's why it sucks. But like this movie is so boring, man.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing captivating about the romance. There's, somehow this movie has a backdrop of World War II, and it could explore themes of occupation and the heart wants what it wants and all this stuff. But instead, it's just like a bunch of guys drinking and dancing a lot and singing, and we fall in love with them, apparently, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, this movie is so uninvolving on virtually every level. It forgets to have a story for very long stretches. And, you know,
absolutely.
Like, there's no sense of pacing. There's no sense of like sequencing of events. You know, character relationships are one way until they're not, you know. and the performances in this movie, especially from Nicolas Cage and Christian Bale, are goofy as hell. Are completely out of place. Like everything feels like it's like, oh, and then this happens, like kind of event, you know. Mm-hmm. Like something will happen in the plot and then it'll be like, oh, and then this happens and then this happens and then this happens and then this happens and then the movie's over, you know. Also, this movie is called Captain Corelli's Mandolin, and yet there's not like a ton of mandolin in this. That was like my main complaint, was that we had to wait 37 minutes to get to the mandolin. I checked, and
I'm proud of you.
I mean, the mandolin appeared on screen before then, but there's no playing of the mandolin until 37 minutes in. And even then, like, it's played like once or twice throughout, but it's really like the title of the movie should be what the movie's about, right?
Yeah.
This movie isn't about the mandolin.
I don't get why that's the title or what. Everything about this movie.
I feel like when you're going to call your movie Captain Corelli's Mandolin, Nicolas Cage should be like Will Ferrell in the cowbell sketch from Saturday Night Live. just playing that mandolin like every 5 minutes and like shouting at people and being like, you know, we don't have a ton of movies that feature the mandolin. And I would be doing myself a disservice and every member of this cast if I didn't perform the hell out of this thing.
Yeah, I agree. They should just take that whole skit.
I would have much rather they just did the cowbell sketch from SNL. It happened around the same time. So if they could have just adapted that into a 1940s World War II drama.
It would have made perfect sense.
That would have been great. John Hurt would be a great Christopher Walken, I think. Anyway, Mike, what did you think of Nicolas Cage in this movie?
Oh, man, what is there to think, really? He is, I don't understand the accent choice. I mean, which is what the whole thing is. Yeah. everyone has an accent in this movie, which, like, as you said, most of them are Greek, or you know, the ensemble cast, I guess.
Yeah. What's weird is that, I mean, almost everybody in this movie is Greek or Italian, except for the four lead characters who are supposed to be the Greek or Italian.
Yeah, I know. That's the best part. John Hurt, I'm willing to give him a pass. But everyone else, come on.
Yeah.
Cage, somebody is supposed to be this, loving life, kind of in the face of war. Like his quote was that, you know, even Italians were notorious for not being motivated to fight, I guess. I don't know.
Sure.
But he just kind of comes off as like a smarmy asshole with a mandolin that has a really shitty accent that you can't look past.
Yeah. Man, like I love Cage, you know, sincerely. Like I truly do. And that's why we have this podcast. This is one of the goofiest accents I've ever seen.
If I do that, I'll start getting confused about when I'm supposed to come in. And that, in a concert hall, would be a disaster.
Ever in history. We always talk about the accent or the voice he's using.
Yes.
And this is the one that wins.
This is the most, like, peculiar and the most, like why are you doing it? I mean, I'm not even going to say it's the most peculiar because I get why he's trying to do an Italian accent.
Right.
As opposed to other movies where I'm like, why is he doing this voice? Like like I'm like, Peggy Sue got married when he's doing that like really nasally thing. Like he's going on. But like, it's just so weird. Like he and Christian Bale sound like they took their accent lessons from like Mario and Luigi, you know, like Christian Bale is supposed to be doing like a Greek accent. As opposed to Italian, but it sounds very similar to Cage's Italian accent.
Right.
He's doing, it reminded me of this is a show that I don't reference that often because I haven't watched it in many years. Like I've outgrown the show very much. But it reminds me of a scene from Family Guy where Peter goes into an Italian deli and thinks he can speak Italian. And so he just walks in and starts going, bobbity boopy, bippity bobbity boopity boppy. And that's Nicolas Cage in this movie.
he's just going, pretty much.
Bobbity boopy, bippity bobbity boopity boppy. You know?
Yeah. Just shouting, Captain Antonio Corelli. Like, what?
otherwise, like, he's all right. Like, he's doing an okay job in the movie, but it's such a thin story. There's such a thin character. There's not really much to elevate. You know, it feels like there was so much work put in this movie. I feel like you can see the money on screen when you're watching this movie. You know, they shot everything on location, and they shot it, like, in, like, it's beautiful vistas, and it feels like so much work and production went into the story, and it's a story that has nothing in it. You know, there's nothing going on in this movie. And, like, you know, a lot of this movie hinges on the chemistry between Nicolas Cage and Penelope Cruz, and that's virtually non-existent. Like, they barely knew who each other were.
Yeah. I feel like it's set up in such a way that we're supposed to feel like this is some grand romance that transcends war and all this stuff.
This is supposed to be, like, a Titanic-esque romance.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. We don't really do anything or go anywhere. I mean, Penelope Cruz and Nicolas Cage fall in love because that's how the script goes. Like, there's basically, there's no There's no emotional attachment, it feels. Yeah. Like you said, that it feels like things are one way until they're a different way.
Exactly. And actually, I just mentioned Titanic, and I hadn't really put it in my brain until just now, but I can totally imagine this being greenlit because Titanic was as huge as it was. This was probably around, this is a couple of years, Titanic was in 97, this was 2001, so the production would have been rolling around that time. So right. I could see Titanic being a huge hit and a producer being like, okay, we gotta make another historical drama that has like this vast sweeping romance attached to it with these two people from the opposite side of the tracks.
Yeah, get the guy from Shakespeare and Love to direct it. and we'll have a hit.
Yeah, and I mean, the thinking behind it is solid. I feel like it was executed very poorly. And it's the same thinking that's got Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor made. You know, that's a movie that is also, just directly ripping off Titanic.
It's the same plot as Captain Corelli's Mandolin.
Yeah, Pearl Harbor and Captain Corelli's Mandolin are the same movie.
You heard it here, folks. Heard it here first, folks. That's how that sentence goes.
Yep. All right, Mike.
Stay tuned for more hot takes.
How do you think this fits into the roles that we've seen Cage play so far?
I don't know, man. This is more of the leading hunk Cage attempt in this one, at least.
Sure.
But it feels so flat that I don't feel strongly either way, or whatever the Futurama quote is.
Yeah, I
can't remember right now.
I will say this isn't the first time we've seen Nicolas Cage play an Italian soldier, unless we forget Tempo di Uccidere.
Right.
And I think he comes off as less rapey in this one, so that's a plus.
So that's nice.
That's an improvement. and it's also not the first time we've seen him go for an accent. You know, we've seen him do ridiculous voices before, but specifically an accent. He did one in Raising Arizona. He did one in Con Air.
Right.
And so now he's going for the Italian one, whereas those were more of a Southern kind of thing he had going for him. I think he can pull off Southern a lot more than he can do Italian, and he can't really pull off Southern that well. at least in Con Air. I think he does a great job in Raising Arizona. Con Air, not so much in terms of the accent.
Right.
But also, I did want to point out this is the latest in a line of Nicolas Cage war movies that don't really have to do with the war. It's not really like a traditional war movie. Right. So, there was Racing with the Moon, and there was Birdie, and now there's Captain Corelli's Mandolin. And I think what's interesting about this compared to those two, you know, those two were so early in his career that the kind of roles he was playing was like the young kid who's his first outing in a war, like it's his first time seeing
war. Yeah, it's more the coming of age story.
Yeah, whereas this one he's playing a more senior war officer, which I think is kind of interesting. And also one on the opposite side of the conflict.
Right.
You know, in those ones he's playing an American soldier, and in this one he's playing an Italian one. So I think that is of some interest. I think that's kind of neat. But yeah, otherwise, Mike, are there any moments or scenes in this movie that stood out to you? Like anything noteworthy or mentionable at all? Captain Corelli's Mandolin.
I think there is the dramatic turn when the war arrives.
Sure. About
in
like 30
in the third act.
Yeah, which happens about 30 minutes left in the movie.
Right. Yeah.
There's been about 90 minutes of nothing happening, and then suddenly 30 minutes of stuff is happening. But
Yeah. Specifically, the scene when the German soldiers line up the Italian troops and, you know, they pop out of the whatever with the machine guns and kill everyone.
Right.
That had probably the most dramatic emotional impact in the movie, because that is the Gunther, I think, is the German officer's name. What was it? David Morrissey.
David Morrissey's character.
We've gotten to interact, and he has to kill his friends, it seems.
Yes.
But it feels so out of left field for everything else in this movie that it was, I don't know. That's just the one scene that stood out. I guess there actually is another one too, earlier when Gunther kind of starts to befriend them, and they're, with one of the mandolin scenes, when they're all drunk and they ask him about why he believes in the superior Aryan race. It has hints of an interesting character conversation and development, and that's when we learn the Italian, we just want to go home and be friends and stuff.
Right.
And it's almost interesting, but for the most part, it feels like this scene is just dropped to us. We get to watch it, and then we go away, and nothing really happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think a big problem with the war stuff that happens towards the end of the movie is that for the previous 90 minutes, you know, they hadn't developed any of the soldier characters outside Cage. I had no idea who anybody was. And so when they all start dying, I'm like, well, all right. Whatever. Yeah. I know that they like to dance sometimes, and they're all part of Cage's a cappella group, so I guess that's sad. But
right. That's as much characterization as they have. Yeah. We get a shower sing-along, and then we get a beach sing-along.
It was very weird. And, like, honestly, I think David Morrissey's character is probably the most interesting one in this movie.
Absolutely. And yeah.
It probably should have been about him. They could have changed the title of this movie to, like, The Remorseful Nazi or something. You know, I think that's there's more to mine out of what that character is going through than what these characters are going through. And so the movie ends. I do want to say, so all the war stuff happens and, you know, Cage is able to escape. Bale comes back and then he leaves again. Bale exists in this movie solely to just kind of pop in and out as things, as things happen. Like, he leaves at the beginning and then he comes back and then he leaves again and then he comes back and then he leaves again and then he comes back. And it's like, oh, are you here? Like, are you in this movie, Bale?
Right. It doesn't make any sense what his character, I mean, yeah. Like, he goes off to fight in the war and he comes back and he starts the Greek resistance apparently in the town and all this, you know, he's set up to be this like resistance commando guy. And then, like, we don't really talk to him again until he needs to come back and add some tension to the love story, and then he leaves again.
Yeah, it's so, everything it just feels so half-baked. And, like, at the end, I wanted to say at the very end of the movie, you know, all the war stuff happens, and Bale leaves, and Nicolas Cage is able to escape, and the war ends after some time, and life starts to get back to normal. And then out of they're just like hanging at the hospital. Penelope Cruz has become a nurse, and then an earthquake destroys the hospital.
Yeah,
and it's like, oh, okay. And it's like it's just so like tacked on at the end of this movie. You know, it's like, and I get that it actually, like, I know that it actually happened. Like, I looked into it. There was like research. This is all based on like, I mean, it's based on a novel, but the novel is like a historical fiction novel,
right?
And so a lot of these, like, all the this whole situation where this like small Italian troop helped this Greek town resist the German forces, that all happened and stuff. I get that. I understand that all happened. I understand the earthquake happened. But the way this movie plays it out, it's like the war ends and life is bad for a while, and then an earthquake happens and life is even worse.
Yeah. It feels like it's trying to do this, like, the idea is not fully formed enough for me to explain, but it feels like they're trying to do some Greek tragedy shit here. Because earlier in the movie, when John Hurt's character, there's a scene where he's talking to Nicolas Cage and he talks about, you know, this land has had strife for thousands, it's an ancient land, and there's been wars and earthquakes and death and all this stuff. And all these bad things have happened to us historically here in this area, so don't get comfortable, or something he says. which just feels like the least subtle way to then pay off that with a literal earthquake that destroys the town. while we're in the kind of voiceover of a letter that's very poignant and wrapping up the dramatic loose ends and solidifying the theme of the movie, and then literally the building collapses on him.
Yeah, that was it just felt like an odd choice to me, that whole earthquake thing. It felt
very out of nowhere.
Yeah,
and there's also this weird set up earlier in the movie when the war is starting to happen, like, and we're hearing it on the radio and stuff, and John Hurt gives Penelope Cruz a pistol and he's like, use it to defend yourself if you have to, use it on yourself even. And like, I was like, I thought that was gonna set up, you know, like, set up the fact that she's gonna have to kill herself at some point, but it feels like that goes nowhere because that gun doesn't come back ever.
That's true. Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about this, this is based on a novel, like I said, and I have not read the novel, so I can't speak to how good of an adaptation it is. I'm guessing it's not a great one. but I mean, just cause it's a bad movie. So I don't know how good of an adaptation it is, but, you know, a lot of the, reviews that I was reading for Netflix and stuff like that, like the reviews I was reading online, it seems like the novel is a lot more dense than this movie is. And it, like, the movie really cut out a lot of stuff and like, more realistically, it tried to do a lot of different things, but because it can't get into the level of detail that a novel can, everything kind of comes off as like not quite as fully formed as it could be. From what I was reading about the novel, like, there was very much rooted in historical fact. Like, the author rewrote it like 35 times or something in order to get all the details right and all that stuff.
Wow.
And this movie does not. It actually gets the year the earthquake happens, it gets it wrong. Like, it's...
That's amazing.
Yeah, the movie implies that it takes place in like 1947 or something, and it actually happened in like 1953, and it's like, oh, okay, that's
wow, that makes so much more sense. Yeah, Okay, because then when Cage comes back, and he's got gray hair, and it's like, it's only like 4 years, like 3 or 4 years later. Like, what? As right. far as we're shown, because it's 1947 is the last title card we see. Yeah. And then he shows up like, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes after that. So it makes sense that it would be 10 or 15 years later, maybe.
Yeah, it was just very bizarre. And then there's just like, there is small stuff peppered throughout that I did want to mention that just made me laugh. There was a bit where Christian Bale came in. This was like the second or third time he came back. I don't remember which. And he's talking about the letters that Penelope Cruz has been sending him. And you know, she's been like, I haven't gotten any letters back from you. Why haven't you been sending back? And he like has them all on a thing. And it's like, I had somebody read them to me. I don't know how to read. I never learned to read. And it very like it made me laugh a lot because it reminded me very much of the clip from Wayne's World where Wayne is making like a big dramatic monologue and he had like the thing underneath that says Oscar clip. Yep. It's like, and you know what the worst part of it all is? I never learned to read. And I think that's a movie that came out almost 10 years before this movie, and this movie is still at like almost 10 years before this movie, something like I never learned to read was being parodied as like an Oscar clip. And now 10 years later, this movie is still doing that.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, then the scene right after that, cause that's when he comes back and he's, like a deserter. It seems like he's all shaggy and gross. And he's got scabies or some gross shit.
Yeah.
And his mom shows up and like makes a small dick joke. Did you catch that?
No.
It makes no sense. It doesn't. So he comes back and Penelope Cruz puts what's his name? Christian Bale on the table, to heal, like to look at his wounds and stuff. And his mom's there. Christian Bale's character's mom is there.
Sure.
And she's like, oh, this is what it's all for, huh? And she like starts to undo his pants to like get him undressed to look at his wounds. And she's like, it's not a whole lot, huh? And takes his pants off. And I was just like, what the fuck? It made no sense. It's bizarre. I don't know what happened.
That is,
this movie's weird.
Yeah, this is an odd film. I did want to say I did really enjoy the beginning of this movie. Just the first couple of minutes. John Hurt is like narrating and he's talking about he's like at this patient's house. He's a doctor and he heals this deaf man, or he has this guy has a thing stuck in his ear and he's had it in the lodging there since childhood, and he thought he was deaf. He didn't realize he had a thing stuck in his ear, and John Hurt's able to pull it out and basically like heals the guy's ear. The guy can hear again, and the woman's like, and his wife is like, oh, I told you you're not deaf and all that stuff. And then a few minutes later, they're hanging out in like the square or whatever, and somebody is shouting. And the guy who John Hurt healed, looks at him and is like, hey, you don't have to yell. I'm not deaf. And I thought that was a very solid joke. I enjoyed
it. It was good. It was good.
I just want to give the movie credit for that. That was an enjoyable time. The next 2 hours were pretty painful, but that joke was pretty solid.
I do appreciate that the movie ends on that same type of joke also, because their characters interact again as they're just as before the credits roll, where he's complaining and he's asking John Hurt's character as the doctor to put it back because now he can hear all of his wife's nagging. Which is sure, I guess. Yeah. Watching 2 hours to pay off a joke, not so great. not so happy about that. But but it was a nice callback.
Yeah. Anything else? I mean, do you want to talk about the very artistic and tasteful sex scene that was?
Sure, we can do that.
I mean, that's all I really had to say. I just thought I had the soft like gentle mandolin playing in the background, and it was like very like well lit, and like it was just like
yeah,
it was just like a very like artistic sex scene, which you don't see that.
It's always nice.
Yeah, it was very nice. Drunk Cage with the flower, that was kind of entertaining. He's singing in that scene, so that was fun. Penelope Cruz in this movie, like, I mean, obviously she was nominated for a Razzie Award.
And I feel like that's a bit harsh.
It is a bit harsh. I mean, the Razzies are something that I don't take much stock in. I think they generally, they're mostly meant as like a joke, or they're supposed to be. A lot of times they just seem kind of mean-spirited, and they kind of get it wrong what the worst movies are of the year a lot of the time. Because a lot of times they'll give like worst picture nominations to like movies that I think are misunderstood masterpieces.
Just tell us how grumpy it was, Never Stop, Never Stopping, or fucking one of those movies nominated by, because that why you hold a grudge.
No, Popstar was not nominated for any Razzies because Popstar is brilliant. I think it was what was the last, I mean, now I'm curious what the like the last what the I mean, I think actually this past year was a good one. Because it was like this past year was Hillary's America, the Secret History of the Democratic Party, which was like an anti Clinton propaganda movie.
That's amazing.
But like a couple of years before that, I mean, like Jupiter Ascending was nominated in 2015, and that's a movie that's not good. I get it; it's not good, but it's also a very like ambitious and crazy movie, and I think that's something that could be rewarded. You know, that's something that shouldn't necessarily be granted like worst picture status. You know,
right?
Not
okay,
necessarily. The Lone Ranger was nominated a couple of years ago, and that's a movie that I really like. You know. And I get that.
So Mike Smith has a grudge against the Razzies. I get it. It's fine.
But anyway, let's get off the Razzies for a second. I'm saying that Penelope Cruz was nominated for Razzie for this movie. But you know, I don't think she's great in this movie. And she like it comes off as kind of flat. But there is one scene where she really comes alive, and I think that's the dance scene. Where she's like trying to make Nicolas Cage jealous. Like I thought she was like really. It seems like she was really enjoying herself in that scene. And that helps out. That's like a kind of a fun scene, as opposed to a lot of this movie, which doesn't have that much fun going on.
Right.
You know,
for a movie that's supposed to be about love and romance, like not a whole lot of happiness happening.
Yeah. I mean, there is definitely attempts at happiness. There's attempts at like joy, and I think this movie tries to sort of be about like the power of music, but it never commits to the mandolin enough to be that. You know.
That's it. That's the reason.
This movie could have really used more mandolin, man. I'm telling you. You gotta have more mandolin. Anyway, I don't know. I feel like I don't really have that much else to say about the movie, Mike. I don't know if you have any other scenes that you wanted to talk about or anything like that.
No, I think I'm good. Let's hear what the Netflix people have to say.
Let's do that. Let's get into some Netflix reviews for Captain Corelli's Mandolin, starting right now. Here's a 3-star review of Captain Corelli's Mandolin. The premise of this movie is so good. An opera-loving Italian Air Force officer arrives on a Greek island in the midst of World War II and has an angst-filled romance with a local beauty while all of the characters agonize about their loyalty and get caught up in the final tragedy. It could be an opera itself. It stars Cage, Hurt, Cruz, and Christian Bale, for gosh sakes. Why is this movie not better?
Thank you, third co-host.
The accents, yes, those are a problem, but the dialogue is just so ham-fisted, it's intolerable. I wish they had filmed the whole thing without words and just had the characters look at each other and at the gorgeous countryside. And I could not agree with this review more.
Yeah.
That pretty much sums up the last half hour of what we've been discussing.
Like, you can't just read your own review. That's that's not fair.
Well, here's some other ones. Here's a 1-star review of Captain Corelli's Mandolin. The film was a sappy, predictable, and uninspired film with lovely cinematography. Flipping through a pile of Mediterranean postcards would be more inspiring.
yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Here's another 1-star review of Captain Corelli's Mandolin. I wondered how the mandolin would fare for the entire length of this film to discover that it has nothing to do with this ridiculous attempt at a romantic World War II movie. It actually says WW11. Instead of
II.
Yeah, and so I'm assuming they mean World War XI movie. It's more of a caricature than a story, and Cruz only comes alive when she's tangoing in the village square. Cage is pathetically sappy, however the scenery is 5 stars. The reason people run to the Greek Isles, I know only too well, especially how rough the paths and roads are on shoes/tires, etc.
Okay, thanks, Tourism Board of Greece.
Yeah, kind of turned into a travel guide for a second there. Here's a 4-star review of Captain Corelli's Mandolin. Wonderful, feel-good film. Criticisms about Corelli's accent are ridiculous. In real life, he would be talking English or Greek with an Italian accent. It amazes me that people cannot enjoy a feel-good movie without picking it apart. Is everybody a psychologist? Because that's what psychologists do. They tear apart Nicolas Cage movies. and that does bring up a point that, you know, he's saying in real life they would be talking English or Greek with an Italian accent. I got to say, I assume in real life he would be speaking Italian or Greek, right?
Yeah.
This movie, I mean, maybe English, as like a common language. But I feel like, you know, you never really see any of the characters speaking Italian or German or Greek, right? Pretty much English the whole time. And I think that's part of the problem is that, you know, I mean, these actors probably don't know how to speak these languages, and that's fine. But like, maybe don't cast these actors and cast, you know,
right,
somebody who knows how to speak the language, because that always kind of bugs me in movies when you're watching a movie that has two characters that wouldn't normally be speaking English, but they are speaking English for the benefit of an American audience. You know, it sometimes takes you out of the movie. It's a weird thing.
Didn't you know that in ancient Rome they spoke with a British accent? Like, it's science.
That is, yeah. As a side note, I did just go to see a Beauty and the Beast this past weekend, the new Disney remake. And yes. My immediate thought walking out of that movie was, man, there were a lot of British people in this small French village.
Oh, man.
And if we review Beauty and the Beast next week, then that'll be my entire review.
Spoilers for the next film book, guys. Yeah.
Here's 2-star review of Captain Corelli's Mandolin. Basta! Only 30 minutes into this movie, and I could bear no more of the bad acting, bad Italian impersonations, bad Italian language. What a bunch of buffoons!
Yeah.
And finally, here is a 2-star review of Captain Corelli's Mandolin. This is the last one. This was my last shot at watching a Nicolas Cage movie. The story wasn't relatable or believable. The plot meandered. Some of the acting wasn't very good, but the scenery was beautiful. I think this quote-unquote inside boy would rather go outside. Don't know what that means. At least, at least Cage didn't confuse quote-unquote screaming for quote-unquote acting. Fail. No more Cage ever.
Thanks, President Donald Trump, for your review.
He's popping up in a lot of these.
Yeah.
I like that he puts quote-unquote screaming and quote-unquote, like, screaming is in quotes and acting is in quotes.
Right.
And, I mean, at the most, only acting should be in quotes.
Yeah. I mean, he is literally screaming, so yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then just all caps, fail, no more Cage, ... ever. And that's a shame. You know, this was his last shot at watching a Nicolas Cage movie. It said so in the beginning. He can't ever watch another one.
That's what a shame for that guy's life.
I'm assuming he's been doing something similar to us. Like, he's been watching 36 consecutive Cage movies. And then this is the one that was like, no more.
That was it.
And you know what?
Which I can't fault him for that.
I was going to say, now after this one, I don't blame him.
We both did say before we started recording that this was the first or one of the first ones that we were both like, man, this is getting hard now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I feel like overall we've probably enjoyed more movies on this podcast than we've not enjoyed, I would say.
It feels that way, but I can't remember what we've said.
At the very least, even like the bad ones are like usually like enjoyably bad, like something that you can like point, like are so like bizarre and so weird that you got to like laugh at and like just be like, you know, like Deadfall is kind of a boring movie, but it's so like bizarre and so insane to watch that you're like, what is happening? There's a dude with a robot claw and like Cage going full. It's like on a 15 on a scale of 10. It's weird. And then you have movies like Trapped in Paradise, which are super boring. Trapped in Paradise was probably the most boring we had watched, most boring movie we had watched up to this point. But even that has like stuff that you can like point to and being like, this is a bizarre choice. This is odd. This is an odd thing that's happening right now. And you know, in this movie, the only thing you can point to as really odd is the accent that Cage is using and the accent Christian Bale is using. Outside of that, this is a very straightforward and just very boring movie. There's nothing going on. There's nothing like happening in this movie that I can point to and being like, you know what? It sucked to watch this, but at least we got to see, you know,
anything.
I was trying to think of an example, but sure. At least we got to see, you know, Cage reciting the alphabet, you know.
Right, yeah.
front to back in its entirety and shouted the entire time, you know. And something like that, you know. At least we got to see, like, Brian De Palma's crazy camera swooping through around the action. And I that's a bad example because I loved Snake Eyes. That was a great movie, but...
Yeah. But we know what you're saying.
At least we got to see Joaquin Phoenix going full like weirdness in 8mm and stuff like that. Like,
right.
you know, just this movie doesn't really have anything that I can be like, at least we got to see this, you know. Yeah. And that's its biggest fault, is that, you know, I can forgive a movie for being bad if it's at least like admirably bad, you know, if it's like,
yeah, if it at least was trying to do something original or unique or interesting,
yeah,
or fun or silly.
And if it's something that I'm going to remember too, is the thing. Like, right. I'll remember Dana Carvey's stupid voice in Trapped in Paradise forever.
Till I die.
It'll be the last thing I hear as breath escapes my lips. But this movie, I feel like I've forgotten about almost entirely at this point. Like, and I watched it yesterday, you know? So Captain Crowley's Mandolin, I cannot recommend on really any level, unless you want to check out Nicolas Cage's accent, in which case I'd recommend looking at a quick YouTube video or something. Like,
yeah,
because there's not even any like scene in this movie that I can point to as being like, this is a ridiculous Cage scene, you know? It's
yeah, that's a very good point. There are no Cage freakouts, Cage interesting things happening.
Yeah.
In that department in this movie at all.
Like, there's he's having a little bit of fun with the accent at certain points, and like that's kind of sometimes fun to watch, but there's nothing like on the level of like what you want out of Nicolas Cage. And so it's just a bummer of a movie all around. It's a shame. Captain Crowley's Mandolin, no go, no pass.
Hard pass.
Hard pass. So Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons and Dragons, my friends and I post our games on youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com and thecrookedscoreboard.com. I've been writing some articles there as well. Thank you so much for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. You can help support this podcast and Filmbook by taking part in our Patreon campaign. You can find our Patreon campaign page at patreon.com/filmbook. And, you know, feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks for another episode of The Complete Works, in which, you know, we'll be talking about a movie that's, I don't think will be good, but at least we'll probably reach the admirably bad status.
Hopefully we can find it.
Hopefully we can find it. It's going to be a little difficult to find, but we're going to be talking about Nicolas Cage's role in 2001's animated classic Christmas Carol, the movie.
Who can forget it?
Well, no, I mean, it's a Christmas Carol movie, so nobody could. It's timeless, right?
Yeah, true. You're right.
At the very least, like, Christmas Carol to me is a story that is, it's a really great story, and it's one that I feel like works in pretty much any context. There are so many different versions of Christmas Carol, right? There's,
right,
you know, the 2009 one with Jim Carrey, there's the Muppet Christmas Carol, there's the George C. Scott Christmas Carol, there's Mickey's Christmas Carol, and there's probably like a Star Trek Christmas Carol, and all. I would not be surprised if there's an episode of Star Trek that is just a Christmas Carol.
I would be shocked if there wasn't.
Exactly. And so, you know, this will be interesting. In this movie, Nicolas Cage plays Jacob Marley. And this is an animated movie, so it's going to be the voice of Jacob Marley, and I imagine it will allow him to go full nuts. I really hope it allows him to just go like all out with this Jacob Marley. Like, he's playing a ghost. He's playing a ghost in this movie. Like, that's,
or maybe we'll get to hear his British accent.
That would be interesting too. But this movie actually has a surprisingly solid cast. Kate Winslet is also in this movie, which is insane.
Save it for the episode, Mike.
I guess so. I'm so flabbergasted that this thing exists, I guess we'll have to find it. I mean, I think we'll be able to find it through services, but it's,
by means.
It's not available to stream anywhere. It is available to rent on Amazon for like $12, legally speaking. So there's that, but really, it's very difficult to find. So Christmas Carol,
we'll see what happens.
Christmas Carol the movie is our next movie, and I am eager to discuss it. Plus, you can keep an eye out for Film Bookcast, where we're going to be talking about something, and we don't know what it is yet, but I did see Beauty and the Beast, so that's definitely an option.
Sure.
You know, there's also Ghost in the Shell, which, depending on the reviews, we can check out that. Like, I don't really want to see if it gets bad reviews, but if it gets good reviews, then maybe, you know.
Maybe. We'll see what happens.
We got plenty of options next week, so we'll keep you guys posted on that. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thanks for getting in the cage. Thank you.